Hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast, your weekly dose of inspiration and exploration. Join me, your host, Sam Harris, as I discover how mindset can help you do incredible things through my conversations with the world's most interesting people, from tech billionaires to leading scientists, best-selling authors to notorious hackers. The goal is to increase our collective wisdom and attitudes to make us all happier and healthier, wiser and wealthier. Who doesn't want that? On the podcast today, I am very honored and delighted to have Jan Tarlin, one of the founders of Skype, as well as many other quite large companies. And he's a bit of a genius, a very interesting human being, and it was a delight to have his time, really. Very grateful for him. And sadly, the audio quality is not quite perfect. We did use Skype, which is not the platform that I normally use for recording my podcasts. But when you're interviewing the founder of Skype, you don't exactly want to be like, oh, by the way, can we just use this other thing? So we used Skype and my setup wasn't perfect, but it's fine. You'll get used to the things and you can hear everything. He is Estonian and one of the more famous people in Estonia. Basically, all of my Estonian friends know who he is, which I guess is my only gauge on Estonian fame. And so I think he's famous in Estonia, but deservedly so, because he's a bit of a character. We only had an hour, sadly, but it was a very fascinating hour to hear how he went into becoming a developer and his time in physics and lots of different things that we go into. And I won't explain them all to you now because we're going to go into them over the whole podcast. But basically, really interesting guy, and I'm sure you will learn a lot from this podcast, and I hope you enjoy it. So today we have Jan Tarlin, an Estonian hacker, entrepreneur, investor, and physicist, most well known for being a co-founder of Kizar, the infamous file sharing platform, and then Skype, which changed the way we communicate across the world. Since then, you sat on the advisory board to the president of Estonia, co-founded the Center for the Study of Existential Risk, co-founded the Future of Life Institute, co-founded MetaMed, a personalized medical research company, and you're also an investor in a variety of startups, accelerators, and a partner of the seed stage investment firm Ambient Sound Investments. So quite a lot of things, and you're not exactly ancient or anything, so pretty rapid succession of doing stuff. But one thing I wanted to ask was, I've known quite a lot of people with a degree in physics that go on to be great software programmers and entrepreneurs. Do you think there's a relationship with what you learn on physics to them becoming a good programmer and entrepreneur? Or is it that people who are interested in physics are also interested in these other things? It's not actually a causal link.
I think that's definitely the correlation, which I can explain. I'm not sure if like which way the causality flows, but I mean, the correlation, I sometimes say that there are two kinds, roughly kind of two types of people, people and atoms people. Which basically kind of corresponds to what is the fundamental ontological unit for people. So,
what's people who think we unit? Sorry.
Yeah. Ontological unit is basically sort of the, or should I say just perhaps a, like a, just a unit, like okay. Basically the building block, the basic building block from which your world model is built up from. So, if you're kind of main environment is other people, if you're like a manager or leader for that purpose, then you have to think a lot about like what other people do, etc. And like atoms are basically something that they are like something for chemists, like they work with atoms. Whereas like if you're an atoms person, then you're kind of think that, well, the world is composed of atoms and people are composed of atoms. So like the fundamental unit is atoms. And then you're going to start to think about, you might be drawn to physics, for example, which is kind of like a sort of ultimate science about atoms, or you might be drawn to engineering and you're ideally you want to kind of combine those two. Like if you combine them really well, you will end up, like Elon Musk, like he keeps talking about how to kind of reason from first principle, which is like, reasoning from the world of atoms.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, you did cut out a few times, so maybe we'll turn off the video.
Sure.
Sad times. Nice. But yeah, that was, yeah, quite fascinating the way you think about that. Also, I saw more on the subject of like correlations and things. I was going into your Reddits and you had some interesting theories around how programming kind of helps you think. And I was wondering if you could sort of explain that, because I've been getting more into programming. I have found that has really helped the way I think about processes and how I'm approaching things. And you seem a bit more expert at this than me.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things that people don't necessarily realize how why programming is good for cognitive process in general. So one thing, it kind of helps you develop intuitions about what it means to have your thoughts fully specified. Because if you don't have your thoughts fully specified, they won't compile. You can't turn them into a program. So you will get understanding what it means to kind of have your thoughts at the level where a computer could understand it. And also conversely, you can understand what other people have thoughts that are fully specified, or are they just winging, which is usually the case.
Yeah.
The other thing why programming is useful, I think it's kind of teaches you epistemic humility. Every programmer knows that there's numerous situations where you're super convinced that you have things kind of nailed down and you're correct, but then it turns out again and again that you're wrong.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And you often sort of think you're doing everything correct and you're kind of looking for I just missed a bracket or something, but actually you're just in the wrong whole approach and you just need to step back and really fundamentally rethink how you're doing everything. And
exactly.
It's quite good. Yeah. I'm just being wrong for the past day. I've been really stupid. And yeah, it's quite humbling in that sense. Yeah. Also, I quite like when you're doing algorithms, then you have the way of you're doing it and you get to the end and you produce the result. And then you look at someone else who's done it completely differently and you realize that you can get to kind of any result from so many different paths and sort of equivalent for life in general.
Indeed.
Nice. But we could go into more of your background. So you first, after studying your degree, you were part of Blue Moon, the games company?
Indeed, I run, what we jokingly call the Estonian games industry. Because we were the only sort of international games company in Estonia. So that taught me quite a bit about how to run a company, manage finances, negotiate agreements, and manage people.
Mm, cool. Did you found that with a few other friends, or did you kind of get involved with the people that were already running it?
No, I founded it, co-founded it, and then I was the CEO.
Oh, wow. Didn't realize that.
Basically together with my high school friends.
Yeah, cool. So you just had an idea for a game that you built and then it turned into a company, or did you decide that you wanted to build a company around building games and then?
Right. I mean, I was already interested in programming and was doing a bunch of programming, again, together with my primary school friends.
Yeah.
And at some point, I think we had a trip to Sweden, which was a big deal because the Iron Curtain was just in this kind of last stages of being up. So getting behind the Iron Curtain was a really, really big deal. And a relative of mine suggested that, you're into programming, invest, software costs a lot. Why don't you do a game for that and then try to sell it while you're in Sweden? So we thought that it's not a bad idea. So we started developing a game. And of course, software, the first lesson in software is that everything takes about 3.14 times longer than you think it would. And so it took about 3 times longer as we thought it would. So it wasn't ready for our trip. But luckily, we managed to sell it later on to some company that was doing some kind of metals or oil business with the West, and earned $5,000 from it or something, which was more than our parents had made in their lifetimes.
Yeah, wow.
So we thought that, okay, games business is where we should be at. So we stayed there for 10 years.
Cool. I mean, I guess quite a lot must have happened over those 10 years. What do you think was the biggest event that happened in the next 10 years that you think you should talk about?
Yeah, I don't think there was anything particular, but it was just really good business school, as I already mentioned. Basically learned a lot of things how to create, motivate people, to deliver their things in time. Back then, the games industry worked from Christmas to Christmas, and if you did not go gold, as we told it, like gold copy, by like early November, you were pretty much dead. And also, like, it taught me about sort of what I later, in retrospect, knew was kind of game theoretic problems, where you have agreements that are not really enforceable because people who are supposed to pay you, like, live in a different country and, like, have, like, zero motivation to follow through with those agreements. But, like, unless you basically can motivate them to, you can basically create an expectation that, you are going to be a valuable ally in the future. So,
yeah.
So they actually value the future relationship rather than this concrete agreement. So that's like lesson in game theory, etc. So yeah, those kind of business, building a business lessons were super useful. I don't think that it was like a normal thing you get to deliver a product and then it kind of try to sell it and see what happens. Wait for like good reviews, etc.
Yeah, what's the general process behind building a game for people? Because it's not something I've ever really got into as an industry. And
I mean, one thing is that the entire industry has changed a lot. The way how games were made in the 90s, like pretty much like 20 or 25 years ago, it was like very different. So first of all, we didn't really have meaningful like online games. Mm. So like, games had to be packaged and shrink wrapped, and again, they had to be delivered by Christmas to catch those 2 or 3 weeks during which like most of the games were sold in the world. And they were much more programming heavy than they are now, whereas now they are more like content and art and music heavy. That's actually the reason why we exited eventually games industry, because we had a lot of programming talent, but our ability to produce kind of world-class art was just very limited.
Yeah, that's interesting. So did you literally pivot the company to go and join Kazaa, or how did that, was there like a direct link, or were they sort of kind of separate?
So it was, yeah, there was like one step between, which was that when our publisher in the US, Interactive Magic, went bankrupt, we found ourselves in a situation where it's like, okay, not only didn't they pay the last milestone payments, they're now kind of out of business. So we need to figure out what should we do as a company. And then we stumbled upon, luckily it was like 1999, which was the top of the dot-com boom. So there was like a bunch of interests in enterprises to have their own internet portals, because you needed to have one in order to double your stock price. So we ended up developing an internet portal for joint venture between Tele2 and MGM Group in Sweden. And that internet portal, their CEO was Niklas Zennström, the guy who later became the main guy behind Skype and Kazaa. So that's how we kind of met up with Niklas and Janus. And in 2000, no, I think it was 99 still, or was it early 2000?
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm not going to quiz you on like dates.
When they kind of left and asked us to come join their internet consumer startup, which at some point pivoted into Kazaa.
Right. Okay, cool. Then, so you were part of the team building like the foundation of Kazaa then? Or was it Kazaa?
Indeed, yeah. We did the underlying technology. I think Niklas and Janos did outsource the UI to some Romanian programmers, at least at some point.
Mm.
So like the UI wasn't developed by us, but the underlying engine, peer-to-peer engine was.
Yeah, cool. What do you think was like the hardest part in developing sort of the software for that, like that hadn't been around before? Because you guys kind of pioneers in the area.
Well, I mean, we were kind of pioneers, I think neither Skype nor Kazaa were sort of like built from scratch. Like both of them had like predecessors. The predecessors just didn't work as well. So the predecessors of Kazaa were Napster and Nutella. And Napster was like super centralized. It kind of worked well until the court ordered the servers to be powered down. And then it worked like much less well. And Nutella basically had like architectural flaw. It was sort of just completely peer-to-peer without any structure in the network. So it didn't scale. So once you had like enough people on that network, it became like much less usable. So we kind of developed something in between Napster and Nutella to basically have this like compromise between what we call it like two-layer network, where we had like super nodes that coordinated normal nodes and therefore had like a much more optimized traffic. And we later used like a similar architecture for Skype.
Yeah, I've heard that it got related in Skype. What do you mean exactly when you're saying super nodes and nodes, just for people that maybe don't quite get it, like myself?
Yeah, nodes are just computers, like a technical term for computers. If you have a network of computers, then in this network, technically those computers that are running your software are called nodes because they're sort of connected to each other, either directly or indirectly. And the thing was that in Nutella, they were kind of directly connected to each other, thereby like kind of overwhelming each other. Whereas in Ghazal, ordinary nodes were usually connected to super nodes, which there were like much fewer super nodes than there were ordinary nodes. Therefore, like number of connections was much less, and thereby less overwhelming.
Yeah, cool. That makes sense. Nice. So then how did you guys pivot? Well, I guess it wasn't your sorry decision, but how did that then pivot into Skype? You said the technology became part of the underlying.
Yeah, so we first of all, like the entire project became like a turn from engineering project into a legal project because Ghazal was sued in three different continents. And I think at least in two of them, the fight went until the Supreme Court. And we kind of won some and we lost some. But like the thing was that everyone's attention was just in court cases and there wasn't like much time for developing new services and products.
Doesn't sound fun.
Yeah. I mean, it was an interesting experience, certainly.
Lessons.
Okay. But I have some fun memories from that.
That's good.
But indeed, like we at some point we kind of saw that, okay, we have like this new underlying technology or ideas, at least for new architecture that would have been like much more powerful than the original Ghazal technology. But the company who's kind of supposed to be the main client for this is not really able to do anything other than fight lawsuits. So we thought, what else can we do with this like general peer-to-peer technology? And our initial idea was, let's do a Wi-Fi sharing platform. That was where the name came from. The name was originally like a inspiration for the name was Sky Peer. So you have peers in the sky that you can share your Wi-Fi with. But then we thought that we should have like some motivation for people to join that network. So like one of the things that we thought that we should definitely have is like a voice over IP calling service on top of that Wi-Fi network. But then I still have the email from one of the founding engineers whose job was to evaluate all the existing voice over IP offerings. And his conclusion was that, look, guys, none of them really work properly. And we have this kind of underlying peer-to-peer knowledge that we could actually put to use to make a like proper voice over IP architecture. And then we kind of did. We forgot about the underlying first idea, which was the Wi-Fi sharing thing. We dropped R from the Skyper name. The company was called Skyper, but Skyper.com was taken, I think, or Skyper.net was taken. So we dropped R from the end, and then it became Skype.
Wow. That's cool. Like, I like the way it sort of pivoted. Like, quite a lot of ideas do just kind of come from that. So you think both Ghazal and Skype were kind of quite lucky to be the right place at the right times?
Absolutely. So yeah, Ghazal got lucky because Napster got shut down. Like if Napster would have been kept going, like I don't think Ghazal would have been very significant. So it was like just the next best option after Napster. And Skype got really lucky because the broadband had developed sufficiently far. And the year 2003, when Skype launched, also happened to be the first year during which the laptop sales surpassed desktop sales, and laptops are much more suitable for Skype because, well, they're mobile. And also they came, for some reason that I never understood why, came kind of pre-built with microphones. I don't know why people, like why the manufacturers put microphones. There wasn't much use for them before Skype came along, but like we had just this, suddenly this booming platform to tap into.
Yeah, it's funny because I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to put yourself back then, but I don't know what you'd imagine people doing with their laptop for, like, why would they be using
a microphone? I guess it was like for some dictation software, things like that, but I don't think these were popular either.
Yeah, so such an edge case. Yeah, like, I don't know anyone using that. But yeah, it's kind of funny to think back and remember that. I remember when laptops first started becoming a thing, and like, I didn't even get a laptop till, like, I was uni. That was like 2010. And so I never really even needed one before. And now, like, everyone has one. But yeah, so there's definitely a lot of, like, it's not just being kind of lucky and seeing an opportunity. It's also like having all the skills to make the most of that opportunity. So you guys kind of had to invest in teaching yourself to do all these things and having the right knowledge. So do you think if you hadn't been doing what you did do, like, what do you think would have been the best thing for you to do in terms of learning if you had to like go and do something else other than starting a computer games company?
Ah, so like if I wouldn't have gotten into programming at all, I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a difficult one. I haven't thought about it. Programming was kind of, since I was small, I found like computers so attractive.
Mm. Yeah, so you think if you hadn't been doing the games company, it probably would have been something else to do with software, like straight away.
It seems like very likely indeed. Potentially science, but I don't know. That just wasn't half as exciting as programming seemed. Especially, actually, I think that programming was more exciting 20, 30 years ago than it is now.
Yeah.
Because back then, computers kind of represented a potential. If you wanted to, you kind of like looked at a programmer and went like, wow, I can make a really great game. Like, sure, there aren't any great games for it, but I can totally see how I can make one. Whereas now it's like, no matter how much you, how big effort you put into it, you're never going to create something that is just one click away already.
Yeah, I guess in the same, like, 500 years ago, exploring the world when half of it hasn't even been discovered, it's like, cool, I can definitely find something right now. As in, if I want to go and find an island, it's just not really possible.
Exactly, I think that's very, very good analogy.
Yeah, so I mean, need to go to Mars or something if I want to like explore and find something new, which, I don't know, could be cool. But yeah, that's interesting. So I kind of always thought that, like, I hadn't really thought about computer programming that much when I was younger. And so it was only suddenly when I got to like 25 that programming became cool for me. And I kind of feel like I've missed out a bit, really, because it's more just like a means to an end to make kind of business ideas happen rather than entire like cool differences that you were kind of dealing with back then.
Yep.
So, but you still program quite a lot now. So what's your interest in programming these days?
Well, first of all, I just enjoy it a lot. And I do have like a bunch of programming projects that are going to keep me busy. And I have considered and sometimes tried to kind of outsource them. But then like the problem is that I'm going to trade something that is interesting, that is programming, against something that is boring, which is just managing those people who are doing programming or those contractors. So it's like, in general, I really like automating things. So if there's like, I notice that something takes a lot of time from my day, I try to think about how can I put that into software.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for example, like this, it's a very simple case, like with the way we set up this thing, this podcast wasn't by exchanging a lot of emails back and forth, but I just sent you a link to a website that, that explain what's my procedure and allow you to book.
Yeah, I quite like the explanation because I've been sending people like my Calendly link and it's definitely saved my life a lot of stress and time, but it's, you've got a bit
but of this time that isn't really like an automation. It's just like Calendly link embedded in an explanation page.
Yeah.
But like I do have like some more advanced stuff as well.
Ah, cool. And yeah, I really like the principle behind it of like you're adopting the maker schedule of only having one day for talking to people and then the rest of the day is actually doing stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah, I've been getting a lot more talking to people again, which usually stresses me out. I need to kind of cut that back again and get back.
And also, I think that is a difference between I mean, okay, it's not another difference, but it's like so correlated with this like atoms people and people people. Because if you're like a people person, I mean, sure, you need some time to kind of think about like a presentation or something, which is still a sort of a maker's time, so to speak. But usually it's, it's like fine to talk to people and have like make sure like talk to people every day. Isn't really a problem.
Yeah.
But if you're an atoms person who tries to kind of think, bend nature to your will, then talking to people can be a distraction.
Yeah, definitely. So would you say that you're more of an introvert traditionally?
Like when I did this like Myers-Briggs personality type test, then yes, I was an introvert there.
Yeah.
So according to some measures, yes. According to some other measures, I'm not. So
it is like a changeable thing. So I'd say I used to be a massive introvert, and now I'm like an introvert that knows how to be extroverted kind of thing.
Is there something that interferes with your happiness or is preventing you from achieving your goals? Well, maybe you need some BetterHelp. And conveniently, BetterHelp quite literally exists in the form of an app called BetterHelp. So, counselling from a licensed therapist is just a really good idea. I can't tell you how helpful it is to unpack your problems confidentially with another human instead of bouncing around your own mind, often making things worse for yourself. So I'm delighted to be both using and promoting BetterHelp, the app. Basically, it's an online counselling app where you get matched with a qualified therapist of your choice. They have over 3,000 licensed therapists, and you can specify your requirements to get a therapist perfect for you and your problems. So whether you're depressed, angry, anxious, suffering from trauma, if you only feel comfortable with like a gay, black therapist, then you can put that in your preferences, and that was what you will get. So you can talk over text, chat, phone, or video at times that suit you and get started in under 24 hours. It's available on most normal electronic devices where you can schedule in calls weekly pretty much. And financial aid may also be available to those who qualify, so it's really worth investigating. But if not, you do still get a good deal with 10% off using the code GROWTHMINDSET. So why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/growthmindset. Simply fill out the questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor that you'll love within 24 hours. That's betterhelp.com/growthmindset.
Anyway, back from the tangent to Skype. Do you think there was a point where you suddenly realized it was going to take off with Skype?
The point was pretty much like a few days into it, after the launch. I remember doing, or was it a couple of weeks into the launch? What we did, but similarly to Kazaa, we had this online counter, like every client had this number showing how many people are online or connected to the network at this moment. And we basically just suddenly, immediately kind of saw this. Initially, we just like launched Skype and then started just calling our friends on mobiles and other phones to basically urge them to come online so we could kind of increase this online number. But like soon enough, it just like started increasing without us pushing it. And then a couple of weeks into it, I plotted the numbers, the historical numbers on a log scale. That is sort of like a scale that makes exponential growth look linear. And then I got like perfect line, which means that the growth was perfect, the exponential. And then I calculated that we're going to run out of people like later this year, that is in 2003. We need to kind of like get more like extraterrestrials using Skype. But of course, then the growth like leveled off a bit. So like we didn't kind of get 7 billion, or was it like 5 billion back then?
Wow.
In our first.
Yeah. So that's cool. So did you kind of know what it was like the moment that got it to go viral? Like what was the, sharing facility that made that happen?
Yeah. So looking back, I mean, before the launch, I was like one of the engineers who was kind of like reserved or skeptical even about the potential of Skype, because of the microphone issue. I didn't really have a laptop, back then. And, my computer didn't have a microphone. So like I was actually developing a software that I really couldn't use before I went out and bought the microphone. So it's like, I thought like, that's like a really big ask that we're asking from users. But I didn't really think about the laptops. I didn't realize that laptops have microphones. and also later that kind of entire industry got started, just selling microphones. So you could use Skype, and we even had like a department in Skype that was doing like certifications.
That's funny. Cool. Then I read that you did like a calculation on the back of a napkin once at a party to work out how many relationships that you saved because of Skype existing.
Yeah, so I was at the party now I remember, going back to the previous question, I probably can edit it. But otherwise, like Skype was like a super, super viral from the beginning because, having more contacts made Skype more useful to everyone. So it's like everybody was incentivized to get their friends on it. So that's the kind of the reason for the initial exponential explosion, at least. So back to the party. Yeah, I was once at the party. Everybody had to introduce themselves when I had some time to think about it, what I will say. And I said that I can probably take credit for about 1 million human relationships that I have saved by writing a piece of software. And everybody was very confused about that. But that idea is that like I do get pretty much everywhere I speak, I get people coming from the audience and kind of thanking me for creating a piece of software that kind of helped them to be in touch with their partner or in touch with their children, grandchildren, etc. There was even like one company video that was done for a company meeting, like a parody video. There was like this line, Skype. It's a great conspiracy to ruin the lives of grandchildren everywhere.
What? That's funny. Yeah, that's sad, because otherwise, it's definitely interesting to see how many people, like, I was on, like, the Reddit Ask Me Anything thing that you did ages ago. Like, there's so many people, like, just thanking you, and it's like, oh, yeah, you sort of take it for granted now that we have things like Skype, but you forget that long-distance relationships were really hard back then, and calling people and stuff wasn't such an option, and suddenly... Yeah, you could have like video calls, and it just made you feel so much more connected.
I think I'm a big fan of Daniel Kahneman's System 1, System 2 theory, which is like System 1 is sort of your intuitive self, and System 2 is your kind of conscious, deliberative self. And I think that video calling is like a massive help for relationships for the reason that it's kind of System 1 heavy. Mm-hmm. So your System 1 is like most of your brain, but it's like just intuitive pattern matcher. It's not very deliberative. It's in charge of generating your feelings. So you, like whenever you have video call with someone, the System 1 gets kind of fooled into thinking that you were just like very close proximity to that person. And also like, saw their body language, etc. So it kind of is really helpful for, building trust, and that is obviously very useful for all sorts of partnerships, be it business or personal.
Yeah, that's a good explanation. So what do you think about the future of VR and having calls and meetings and stuff?
I think it's obviously very promising, but they're still going to be fairly clunky devices. And there are some senses that are obviously missing. The most important, the kind of sense of touch that is kind of much harder to replicate in sort of interaction with the environment. So it is kind of in early stages, but as they get better, it's obviously going to be even better than video calls for long distance partnerships.
Yeah, cool. So back to like the systems thinking and thinking like a programmer and stuff. What do you think about like the sort of ideas around the fact that our brains are just operating different algorithms at different time, and when something pisses you off, you kind of just have the angry algorithm come and override what you're doing, and you don't really have that much control. Would you kind of agree with these kind of statements?
In general, I think so, yeah. It seems very plausible that we are just like a huge collection of heuristics that kind of implement various behavioral patterns. But interestingly, there is this top top level algorithm, or like, is it, sometimes you can call it it's a bottom level, because like in some very important sense, it seems to be under the control of the earlier parts of the brain. That's why we kind of so forget the words of a speech when we are supposed to kind of give a speech, because the system one perceives like a threatening situation and turns off. The system two was that was preparing the speech.
Yeah.
I lost my train of thought here. Exactly. That's a case in point, right?
Yeah, perfect. Wow.
But there's this deliberative part of our brain that can do things like programming, for example. And there's like, in some sense, Turing complete, there is this term for computations. Sufficiently powerful computations are in some sense isomorphic to each other. So like humans have this part of the brain that is Turing complete that can kind of simulate almost arbitrary processes.
Mm.
Whereas the system one thing is seems to be something that have in common with animals and is not really up to doing things like programming or science.
Yeah. Okay, cool. It's getting kind of meta, but I like it. So also on this kind of level, when you start thinking more like genes are just sort of programs and algorithms for like coding for the next level of genes and sort of how the whole evolution happened to get the human race to where it is and our level of being able to think consciously is sort of all just happened by chance. I guess it feels kind of inevitable that then AI will reach singularity somehow, because if like nature can already make it happen, we can probably make it happen even faster, kind of thing. So what's your kind of goals with the Center for Existential Risk and managing AI problems?
Yeah, so that is like a huge topic now.
Jump into it, you know.
Yeah, so one way to look at things is that like the reason why we are sort of dominant species here and the reason why the environment is for good or for bad under our control, the reason why a lot of species have gone extinct, mostly have to do with the fact that we have been modifying the environment to make it uninhabitable for them. So the reason we can all do all that is that we are the best planners on this planet. We can kind of like see the consequences of our actions the farthest and then search for policies that are not perfect, but they're much better than chimpanzees can come up with, for example. So like if we are going to introduce something that is better planner than us, and indeed like there is no reason why we shouldn't be able to do that. At the end of the day, if we really are not smart enough to figure out how thinking works, we can like just point to evolution. Evolution had no idea what it was doing either. So we can just brute force it by running, just throwing a lot of compute at finding solutions. Or we can scan human brains and run them faster, which also gives us kind of superhuman intelligence. And once you have superhuman intelligence, again, it's arguable that the planet will no longer be under our control. And most particularly, I am concerned with environment no longer being under our control, because that what has been fatal to so many species. They are accustomed to a certain environment. They're biological, so like big changes in the environment are going to be lethal for them. And we are also biologicals. And like if you change the content of the atmosphere or dump it all together as superhuman AI might want to do because it's better for it, we're going to be dead. So that's going to take the time before that happens to ensure that nothing drastically goes wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of deep, really. What do you think are the things we can put in place to ensure that it doesn't happen in a way that the AI would change things? If it's so much more intelligent than us, how can we really stop it? So like the analogy of it's like a group of kids playing in a playground or something, and then one of them's going to have an adult. And like they just think on a completely different level. Well, more like if you have a group of ants and they're going to get like a human child that's going to help them build everything, but then the human turns into an adult and has much different interest to the ants. And if we're just ants compared to this other thing, how are we ever going to control it?
Exactly. So, I mean, one important point is that the AI is not going to be an alien in the sense that it's just not going to land on this planet, but it's going to be a human creation. So we do have this degree of freedom trying to plan ahead, again, using the mostly crappy algorithms that evolution gave us, and try to figure out what should we do to get what's now known as aligned AI. That is AI whose idea about the future is mostly aligned with what humans consider a good future. So at the point where it is a better planner than we are and is going to kind of take actions to modify the future, it should modify the future towards what you consider a good future. I mean, like a decade ago, so I had like an argument with an AI developer who was kind of very skeptical of trying to do what I just said, and said, well, look, once we have AI that is smarter than humans, its actions are going to be completely incomprehensible to us. Like it's like rabbit trying to interpret or predict what AI is going to do. So the AI is going to be completely unpredictable. And then my answer to him was like, well, why exactly are you trying to create an unpredictable rather than good future? You should be creating good future, not unpredictable one. So that's like in some sense, there's a bunch of like homework that AI researchers A, have to do, and B, they are not really motivated to do because they are just motivated by adding competency to AI, not so much by adding transparency and controllability. So I've been cultivating an ecosystem of organizations, people, and projects that are sort of trying to do that homework and figure out how can we actually align an AI that could potentially be smarter than humans.
Yeah, definitely. In terms of capitalism, it's the first person to make the AI will get rich first. So it's the incentive to kind of make it as powerful as possible as quickly as hell, rather than keeping it in check and being the person to get there second kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. If it's in some kind of like race situation, but that I think is really important to avoid. Because like if you're in a race situation, you think that you have to do this thing because otherwise the other person is going to do that, the other country is going to do that. Yeah. This means that you no longer have free will. Like you're not going to be able to plan because your actions are going to be predetermined by game theory, which is a bad, really bad situation to be in.
Yes. Yeah, we're kind of terrible. But something I've kind of been thinking about more because I was a biologist, I haven't really read, but I feel like someone must have thought about it. It was like, you know, like the selfish gene theory and like the reason humans kind of got to where they were from like evolution of genes that just were the selfish ones and got recreated most. Is there not something kind of like a selfish consciousness theory, as in like the mind that selfishly decides to replicate itself more or establish itself? Is it ultimately going to be the one in control? So if we make a consciousness, even if 99 million of them are really nice, if one of them has like a selfish action within it, it's going to kind of take over and inevitably run everything kind of thing?
Yeah. That's the reason why I do think that unipolar outcomes are more likely than multipolar, because unipolar is more stable than multipolar. Yeah. If you have a kind of evolutionary thing, it's going to be much less predictable. So like even though like multipolar outcomes kind of feel nicer to us, I claim that they are less predictable, therefore more random, therefore more dangerous. So like I think we should actually try to go for outcomes that are either unipolar or have fewer polarity. That's actually like one. It also kind of related to races. So I kind of encourage everyone to read OpenAI's charter. Like one really nice thing that they say there is that they do not want to contribute to races. So like whenever they see that like a good nature project is pulling ahead of them, then they will try to join the project rather than compete with it.
Yeah, that's cool. So how did you go about getting involved in AI and starting the center with like Martin Rees and like some really cool
Hugh
people?
Price.
Yeah, Hugh Price, not Howard. Yeah, how did you go about like getting in touch with them and just sort of starting it? Were you like at a conference together? How did this idea happen?
Yeah, Hugh Price has written a New York Times piece about it. It was kind of my route to existential risk. Taxis in Copenhagen or something like that. Yeah, I met with Hugh at the physics conference. Max Tegmark, who's my co-founder at another place called Future 5 Institute, the professor at MIT. He organized a physics conference, and I met Hugh, who was also a physicist, there, and ended up kind of convincing him that this is a very serious topic that needs attention. And he was right back then, he was transitioning from Australia to Cambridge and kind of needed a team, so to speak, for his activities there. So I thought that that sounds like a very important and neglected team. So he put me in touch with Martin Rees, who also had been thinking about the end of the world, so to speak, for a while. And we kind of think we made a good team.
Yeah, cool. So, and then then you guys put in money to like start the thing, but then what do you kind of actually do? You have people employed just researching AI? It's just like, what's the center? Like, what's its data operations?
So the CSER Center is rather, and again, I kind of support the entire ecosystem of organizations and have co-founded two of them. So they're like, all the organizations are somewhat different. CSER specifics is that CSER is rather broad in terms of topics. It doesn't just focus on AI. It has also things about, even though its name says existential risks, also things about catastrophic risks, such as nuclear, for example, or climate change. And it tries to kind of like be to a very heterogeneous place. It's doing really well in kind of thriving in the academic environment that is Cambridge. It kind of like puts it in a very different place that, for example, MIRI, Machine Intelligence Research Institute in Berkeley, that was the first organization that I was attracted to back in 2009. But that is not academic, and therefore, they don't have, from one hand, they don't have the possibilities and reputation of a world-class university. On the other hand, they don't have the constraints either, so like, they can do very different things than CSOC can.
Okay, so what are the kind of different things that you'd be doing? Is it just taking more action, or?
You mean now CSER? You mean the Cambridge Center?
Yeah, compared to the universities doing research, you said you have the power to like do more radical things, but like, what kind of things?
You mean MIRI? Okay, so MIRI, what MIRI can do is sort of, for example, one thing that they do is they don't publish things automatically. They basically have taken and also advocate. I think it's an important principle that if you have research that is potentially dangerous, you should kind of like think like take, not publish by default. You can actually do the research and then take time to think about it, if and how to publish it. I think I'm kind of advocate that to like all the AI companies. In fact, like OpenAI just had this led by example a month ago or so, where they didn't publish the algorithm behind GPT-2, the text generation algorithm, and got some flack for it, but I think it's a responsible thing to do. So, but like if you're in academia, like there's this principle called publish or perish. So you actually need to publish all the time. That is your main thing. So yeah, that's just one example of things that you're constrained if you're academia. On the other hand, you're more empowered. You can, it's easier to recruit, for example, et cetera.
Last few things then. Is there any amazing books that you've really had that kind of changed the way you think, or you think they're like the best things that people should go and read?
Sure. I mean, I don't have like a list. I mean, I sort of, because of the domain that I'm focused on, it's kind of very easy for me to suggest books like Superintelligence by Nick Bostrom, and Life 3.0 by Max Tegmark, and that kind of lay out the problem with AI that we have to figure out. I right now I'm listening to the in fiction I try to consume in audio format. Right now I'm listening to Free Body Problem, which is Cixin Liu's.
That's so good. Which one are you on?
Last one.
I need to start the last one. Yeah, the first two were so good. I like that, like, you know, you're reading it and you feel like you've reached the level of like how difficult it's going to get. And you're like, wow, this is like a new level of like everything's just gone crazy and it's going to stay at this level. And then like the next chapter, like there's a whole nother unfolding of more meta stuff. And you're like, crikey, how does this keep on thinking of stuff?
Exactly. I find it like really interesting that there's like a significant overlap between what the book says and what the people who are really deeply thought about what our future might look like, what their conversations look like.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's kind of really strange, and it comes from like completely different culture. So it's really, really fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. Brilliant. Brilliant set of books. Yeah. Excited to read the last one as well. Nice. And then, can you think of the kindest thing that someone's ever done for you?
Yeah. I saw that, that question on your list. And, I generally find like, questions difficult to ask me to kind of search for like really extreme examples.
Mm.
Because this is, you need to kind of comb their memories over the last 40 years and a lot of those. So I don't think I can kind of give a good answer to that.
Okay, no worries. But so what about on the subject of memories, do you have any like early distinct memories from childhood?
Certainly I have some, but I don't think they are kind of very
interesting. Cool.
Very super interesting, for general audience.
Yeah, okay, no worries. Do you have any advice that you'd like people to keep?
Yeah, I have like a few people that I've been mentoring, and sometimes I try to kind of distill down the things into snappy things, words.
Yeah, perfect.
So I had like a few versions. One is that two phrase. One is that how was it?
It's fine. I mean,
keep progressing and keep contributing. So it's like you want to make sure that you get better every day, and you basically contribute to a project or some other person or something. Basically, that you know makes you valuable for others. That's like one thing. And the other, like a free component version, I think it was be there, be ready, and be reliable. So be there means that you have to like look for places and people around which interesting things happen. Be ready is just, be opportunistic and like look at like where the opportunities are to do things.
Yeah.
And be reliable is like equally important. It's just keep your promises. Don't forget things.
Nice. Yeah, that sort of perfectly embodies what you're saying about like getting lucky with Skype and Kazaa, of like being in the right place at the time, but also being ready to make the most of it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that led to Skype was a newspaper ad, actually.
Yeah.
Like all that led us to join the web portal startup. It's just advertised on a newspaper. Had we just ignored it, we wouldn't be.
It's crazy. There's a good Will Smith quote saying, if you stay ready, you never have to get ready.
I like that.
It's definitely a good one to kind of keep up when you're kind of feeling like getting lazy about things. Nice. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Is there anything that I haven't asked that you think I should have asked?
No, I can't really think of any super snappy things.
Okay. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for the time. Is there anything else you want to ask me?
No, not really. Sorry.
Oh, it's fine. Cool. It's pretty different to go into like all the what you're doing with investing and things, but appreciate you've got stuff to go and do. So was really happy to have any of your time, and thanks. And hopefully get to catch up with you again in the future. Maybe on another accelerator or something, who knows?
Okay. Thanks. Bye.
Ta-ra. You've just listened to an episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your preferred app and give me a good rating, as these go a really long way. If you are unable to give good feedback right now, try sharing the show with a friend who will, or just wait for the show to improve. If you have any ideas for the show or you just want to chat, then please reach out to me on Twitter at SamHarrisTweets or Instagram at SamJamSnaps. Show notes and other links to topics discussed in the episodes are available at the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com. Thanks so much for listening. Give yourself a big hug from me. If you're with a friend, give them a hug as well. And I hope you enjoy your next podcast.